Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to the June 3rd, 2019 For Your Benefit radio show. Today we're going to talk taxes. And who better than to talk taxes with than Dave DeJong and Steve Wittes, both tax attorneys. Dave's a CPA, right?
Yes.
And I believe you are not, because you were smart not to take the exam.
Right.
But you took one equally bad, right?
That's
anyway,
right.
So we're going to talk about taxes in general. They're both with the firm Stein, Sperling, Bennett, DeJong, Driscoll, PC in Rockville. And let's start off with a softball. And it probably could do the whole show. Who were the winners with this change in the law, and who were the losers?
Well, the biggest winners were individuals who owned or were co-owners in businesses that were not C corporations. They got a new type of deduction beginning in 2018 called the QBID, which is short for Qualified Business Income Deduction. Basically, those who had income at lower and mid levels before a phase out or elimination in some cases got to knock 20% off their tentative income, which was a savings of about 7% or so. C corporation owners got a benefit as well, with the tax rate down to a flat 21%, particularly if you had a personal service corporation, you previously paid tax at 35%. So the business community in general got a benefit. Now, the people who weren't so happy on the business side were people who think they should have gotten the QBID, but they didn't. Higher income people caught in that phase out or elimination, and particularly well-paid professionals and consultants. Consultants were treated just like lawyers, accountants, doctors, and dentists. And if their income was over $415,000, if they were married, or over $207,500 if unmarried, no QBID.
Okay, now these consultants could be consultants for anything, correct?
That's correct. It's a fairly broad definition of consultant, and there remain some ambiguities because many people consult and then they deliver a product subsequently. Is the product incident to the consulting? And perhaps the two aspects can be segregated. However, the rules there are very, very tough.
I think this would be particularly important to, and it's a fair percentage of the audience that leave the federal sector and then go back and do consulting, and together with the consulting and the annuity income. And it isn't just D.C., but you have federal centers in Denver, L.A., and these would be highly compensated areas, New York certainly, that if they didn't know this, they could always file an amended return for last year.
That is correct. And consultants and other professionals, particularly if their business is not saleable, may have some advantages in converting their business or practice to a C corporation.
Okay. Now, and correct me if I'm wrong, was there some add-on to somebody that maybe didn't have a business but had a rental property?
Yeah, and this is the most difficult part of a very complex piece of legislation. I think we have to begin with the premise, although this is not the most complicated provision per se, it is clearly the most complicated provision in at least 32 years affecting a large number of people. And right from the beginning, when it was enacted in December 2017, the big question was, is real estate a business or isn't it a business? And there was little guidance in the first 12 months. And finally, in January of 2019, IRS came up with some guidance and says, if anybody spends 250 hours in the real estate activity, it is a business for purpose of the QBID. And in determining whether you exceed 250 hours, you get to consider not only owners' times, but workers' times. You can aggregate it. So if somebody simply has a single rental property, a house, maybe they lived in it previously, and they spend 20 or 30 hours a year involved in the house, it is not going to qualify for the QBID. But if they have an apartment and they manage it themselves and hire people to take care of the repairs rather than use a management company, they may very well qualify. And they have the choice, Bob, of aggregating multiple properties, which will be necessary in some cases to hit the 250 hours.
Let's say that we all know somebody that maybe has a rental property but doesn't want a thing to do with it other than that. So they hire this person to work on it, paint it, weed it, whatever. Does the fee that they pay those people to do those services, does that count in total hours?
Yeah, it does. If you pay someone else, it does count, but they can probably do it a lot quicker than the time you would expend on it, and it may be tougher to hit 250 hours. The key thing is record keeping. IRS is putting the burden on the property owner to keep good records of the time expended and what they did during this time.
We have clients, which I'm sure you do as well, that are maybe working, maybe retired, but their property is not local. Well, local is whoever is listening to this in the States. So they have these properties usually in some place nice to go to visit the property, fix it up between tenants and the like. So does the air travel count?
I'm reaching here, Dave. I've had many clients do the same thing, and I've had some of them audited. It is now pretty clear that your time traveling does not count.
Okay, I'll have to change a few responses. All righty. So winners and losers. I mean, we talked the business side. If I'm sure we could go all day long on the business side, but how about the non-business? The a lot of the people listening are still employed. Some are retired. And they don't want a business.
Yeah, you've heard the good is the QBID deduction.
Okay.
For everyone who got it, that was the good. There's some bad and some real ugly in the act as well. The bad is, I'd say, the singlest situation that qualifies as bad is the elimination of all but $10,000 of the deduction for personal taxes. It's hitting large numbers of people in the Washington metropolitan area, as well as residents in a number of other Northeast states and California, among others. With the loss of the deduction, except for $10,000 for personal taxes, a number of these individuals, primarily upper middle-income individuals, have found that they paid higher taxes in 2018. Some lost the ability to itemize with the loss of the deduction for personal taxes and the doubling of the standard deduction, and then their charitable contributions gave no tax benefit. That's the bad. Here's the ugly. And a number of people have found themselves in situations they didn't expect. And the ugly is the elimination of miscellaneous itemized deductions. This means that people going, for example, for their MBAs, traditionally, if you were working on a full-time basis, the MBA did not qualify you for a new business, and you were able to deduct the cost of tuition and other expenses as a miscellaneous itemized deduction, subject, of course, to that 2% adjusted gross income floor. With the elimination of miscellaneous itemized deductions, that's gone as a deduction. Some small things are gone. Tax preparation fees for individuals, investment expenses for individuals. But here's the one, and I've already encountered several situations that is really, I think there would be bipartisan agreement that this is totally unfair, and that is the handling of taxable damages. In general, Bob, taxable damages, as you know, there has been an offset by attorney fees and costs, with the exception of certain taxable damages for discrimination situations in the workplace. The offsetting expenses had to be deducted as miscellaneous itemized deductions, but they're gone. There's no such thing, at least through 2025, of miscellaneous itemized deductions. Someone gets an award, let's say, of $300,000 in taxable damages, pays the attorney one-third, but he or she is paying taxes on the full $300,000. Federal and state taxes could eat up 45% of it. That's a loss of $135,000. The attorney fees were $100,000, and if my basic math is correct, the person who was injured comes away with $65,000 out of $300,000. Could not be more unfair.
Wow. Is there any provision for somebody maybe in a business to get that in as a business expense?
If it related to one's business, the answer is yes. But if it related to a personal context or even perhaps a sole proprietorship, the answer to that would be no.
Okay, one more, and I don't want to go into the weeds with this, but if somebody had a partnership, let's say it's an investment partnership, not rental properties per se, but they just put all their investments into it, it was a partnership, and there was some provision where they had to expend legal fee dollars because maybe the investment went bad and they felt that the person was giving bad advice. Could that get folded into the partnership?
Well, there's two ways to handle it and preserve the deduction. One way would potentially be to have the partnership deducted and the individual partner just settles up with his or her partners. Another way of potentially handling it, in a partnership or S corporation, your share of income goes to Schedule E on the personal tax return, and you arguably can do an adjustment on the Schedule E to pick up partner expenses or shareholder business expenses.
Wow, thank you. And again, folks listening, this could be a small partnership. I would imagine a good percentage of the listeners are maybe have a small partnership and they have expenses. I hope they don't have these legal fee expenses, but if they do, and if it's a business, it's not necessarily you're not, it's when. Andrew tells us it's time to take a break and let the people take their notes and email us, and we'll be back in a minute. But let's listen to what the sponsor of the show can do for the listeners.
You have life insurance to protect the people you love. As a civilian federal employee, you have two choices designed specifically for you, WAPA and Fegley. The big difference? Price. Chances are WAPA premiums will cost you less. In fact, the average WAPA member saves $375 per year on premiums. Prioritize your peace of mind with a life insurance policy designed for feds by feds. If you're a civilian federal employee interested in comparing WAPA to Fegley, visit waepa.org today. WAPA is a proud sponsor of 4-Year Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Network, 1500 a.m. WAPA has been insuring the future of federal workers for more than 75 years. See why over 46,000 feds have already switched to WAPA at waepa.org.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here June 3rd, 2019. We're speaking with Dave DeJong and Steve Wittes, and we're talking about taxes, income taxes. We'll talk about estate taxes. And at the break, we were talking amongst ourselves. One of the things besides Dave's, you know, spot-on comments with regards to broad-based application to individuals, what about individuals that are considering divorce or getting divorced? What happens there with regards to the new tax law?
Well, there was a one-year delay in these new provisions. They took effect for separation agreements or court orders after December 31 of 2018. But as far back as I can remember, and I've been involved in taxes for 45 years, alimony has always been deductible to the payor, and income to the recipient. For new agreements and new orders of the court, the alimony no longer deductible to the payor, tax-free, just like child support, to the recipient. Now, if you amend a pre-2019 agreement, the old law, deductibility will still apply unless the parties agree in writing that the new law shall apply. But there are two big uncertainties, Bob, if any of your listeners are paying or are receiving alimony. The first of those two issues is, suppose you signed a separation agreement near the end of 2018 and the divorce was not final until 2019, and the divorce decree incorporates or merges the separation agreement entered into in 2018 into the decree. Do we have a 2018 instrument, or has it been merged into a 2019 decree? The other issue is prenuptial agreements. Is a prenuptial agreement a separation agreement as well? If I have a prenuptial agreement and I have to pay $4,000 a month for 7 years, and I entered into it a decade ago, I contemplated deductibility. It would arguably be unfair to change the rules of the game in the middle. So we've got to wait for guidance from IRS regarding pre-2019 premarital agreements.
The agreement has to be signed by that date. It's not necessarily we're in negotiation at the end
of
the
year. It had to be signed. Something had to be signed prior to January 1, 2019.
Okay, listen, I can't help myself because you've taught me so well. Let's say we're coming to the end of the year and we got to sign something, so we sign something, but it's a non-binding something such that the real negotiations will take place after December
31st. It's got to be binding.
Okay.
But you might have been able to do something short and sweet to the extent anything in a marital termination is sweet and fill in the blanks later, but it had to be binding.
Wow. I like this show. All righty. So I think we've, like you said, good, bad, and not so pretty, right? How about on the estate side? I mean, where this is all personal income tax. What's going on in the estate world? What did they change there? What didn't they change?
Well, Bob, the main difference is that as a result of the expanded estate tax exemption, which currently on the federal side is nearly $11.5 million and may change, which we can discuss later, but it has really shifted the emphasis to what I'll call more practical estate planning. The issue of when somebody is selecting their executor, their power of attorney, who would be their power of attorney for health care issues, and if they've got young children, even naming the guardians. That's become the bigger emphasis in how and when will children receive their interests, at what ages, and what are the standards that they should be made. This has become, in a way, probably a better situation because it's de-emphasized the whole estate tax for the vast majority of the population and brought it down to the practical side. As we're living longer and not always in the healthiest way, it's also emphasized disability planning. More and more people, and we often think that maybe estate planning is a bit of a misnomer. They've got to have their power, their financial powers of attorney, their health care directives in place. And it's become a more important aspect for young adults, too, who think, gee, why do I need a will? Well, we all have to worry about getting disabled, much less dying. And the fact is, though, it's become more practical and we're seeing more people, and also a little bit more about asset protection, how things are being titled. Is it what's called tenants by the entirety, or which is slightly different than community property for those out west, but it's made a greater emphasis. We're still seeing for the very wealthy, we're doing quite a bit of estate tax planning, but for the vast majority, it's more, and I'll call the practical side.
So, I mean, these are large numbers, you know, said, well, gee, it's only 5 million, 8 million or whatnot, but is there kind of a threshold that somebody needs to be concerned about estate planning with regards to the value of the estate? I'm not belittling, you know, somebody with less. I think it's important that the assets go as to where the person wants them to go, but the estate tax, what's the threshold there?
Well, it's generally on the federal level, it's about 11.4 million. But what's happened is many states, probably about 18, 19 states, still have some form of a death tax for those situations. So there's a sort of a two-part analysis. One is, does the state have one? And generally, I can say, for example, in Maryland, it's $5 million. But the other concern is on the federal side, and while there's a bill to make it happen sooner, in 2026, the law has having it that'll essentially be halved. So it'll be something closer because of a COLA adjustment to about $6 million. And while that seems like a huge amount, that includes life insurance, includes retirement plans, the value of one's home and their overall assets. Essentially, it's your net worth on the date of death. So one still has to be careful and be sensitive to all these and do some planning as between spouses, possibly charity, how things will pass to the children too.
I have a question, and I don't know the answer. I hope you do. Let's say we have a federal employee that's married, or we have a federal employee that's divorced, and their annuity, once they retire, is paid for life. All righty. But if it then goes to a spouse or a former spouse, is there an estate issue there with the value of that survivor's annuity?
Essentially, so when there's the election to either take the single life annuity or the joint and survivor annuity to cover the spouse, the general impact is that, number one, for what's going to pass to the spouse will qualify for what's referred to as the marital deduction. And the reason that's protected is because nothing will pass beyond the lives of the two spouses. So while it's an incredibly valuable asset to have that annuity, and let's talk about the joint and survivor annuity, it's wonderful that it will cover that surviving spouse. The fact that it doesn't go beyond the lifetime of that surviving spouse means there's no estate tax impact. It will not be deemed a taxable estate following the surviving spouse's death.
Okay, that's at the federal level. Would states argue with that?
Generally, they do not. This, again, assumes it's only for, and it's for a married couple, and it's focused on that. A lot of laws developed about the definition of a married couple, but as long as they are a married couple, it really won't be taxed on most, I don't recall every state's rules, but for the most part, I can envision that it would be taxed to that surviving spouse. There is, I believe Pennsylvania has an inheritance tax. I don't know if that would impact it, but it would be pretty unusual for it to be taxed as a death tax.
Have you seen an uptick in people that have no clue what the law is talking about? And I might be one of them on the estate side, that they come in and say, could you just tell me whether it impacts me or not?
We do. We've got a lot of inquiries. I also worry that there's a lot of people that have become traditionally so focused on the estate tax that when we start talking to them about powers of attorney or medical directives, that they it's almost like they've forgotten the piece of, gee, I better have at least a basic will in place, cover my kids. There's also been a greater emphasis about long-term trusts. Generally, what I refer to as a lifetime trust. So if I am worried about my child receiving assets, let's say by the traditional 30 or 35, many people are worried about who their kids will marry, sometimes referred to not so euphemistically as when the in-law becomes the outlaw. If that all of a sudden that wonderful daughter-in-law, suddenly the marriage splits up, people generally want to keep assets into a trust for the child's lifetime. There's been a much greater trend to have that happen. It's technically called a generation skipping trust, which traditionally impacted to minimize taxes. Now it's more for asset protection. We often refer to it as the parental prenuptial agreement, because you're trying to ensure that that trust will be there for your child in the event of a marital split up. I'm not talking alimony that Dave was referring to. I'm talking about the actual division of that property if the marriage splits up with that child.
What do you feel or when you talk to clients or potential clients? Is there a general comment where they think they know something but they don't? I'm not saying they're bad people. But, you know, I'd like to think I know something, but within 4 minutes of talking to you or Dave, I know I don't. But, and you know, they get that aha moment. Gee, I thought it was like this. And probably major change in the law a number of years ago. People still remember the old law.
All right. I would say it's on two levels. Our biggest aha moments come, I guess, for them. Number one, many people assume they don't need a will. They say, what's the difference? If I die, everything will go to my spouse, and to my later death, you know, if she's not around, it would go to my kids. Two considerations. One is if you don't have a will, essentially for nearly every state, the law, the statute, the state will write one for you. So oftentimes, and in most states, if there are children, in most states, the spouse will get a portion of the first to die's assets, but a portion likely will go to the children as well. There's also the consideration that you may not like how those terms are going to be provided. Does the child get everything by 18 or 21? Most people aren't going to be happy with that. I love my children very much, but it gives me heartburn to think they would get it at such a young age. But also to take control, to ensure that the right person is going to be the guardian, the right person is going to be the executor, and that people often are shocked that they assume certain people will automatically be named and as their backups, and it's rarely the right person they think it should be.
Folks, none of this stuff is premeditated, but I'm going to ask another question. In your meeting with a married couple, is there a single one or two sticking points where one just really dug in their heels and you maybe felt that they shouldn't have, but you were eventually successful?
Well, we do. And as lawyers, we have to be very careful because there's oftentimes, we make it very clear, we represent them both because there can't be any secrets. I would say number one is I've had several times where a wife has looked over at the husband and said, you know, if I die, he's going to marry the first woman that comes along. They're worried that, you know, the money will be given away pretty quickly. Sometimes this isn't always, you know, the most wonderful, charming person that they're talking about, but still the spouse is often worried that, that, you know, the cabana girl will come along pretty quickly. But the other thing that's become a big issue for us is the second marriage. People, and often they're, people have been married 20 years on the second marriage, they're happily married, but they're assuming the surviving spouse will leave everything to the kids equally. So let's say they each have two from the prior marriage. Well, is that a consideration that they should at least think about a postnuptial agreement to understand that it will be given away equally and that we don't have to worry about the problem of that that beautiful cabana, you know, girl coming along? Or if all of a sudden...
It could be a cabana boy.
The cabana boy and... Okay. It could be
all
that
things
too.
Considered.
Right.
All right.
But the other issue is that what if the surviving spouse leaves everything to just their children? That's the other concern, to try to make sure there's some fairness involved.
You both have a way of explaining the unexplainable and having people understand. Wow. Where do we go next? Dave?
Well, let's talk about the future, back to the future, we might say. And we have a pending bill that has passed the House that the Senate is going to consider, which would make some significant changes in the retirement plan area. One of those would extend the current age 70 and a half, when most people have to start taking minimum distributions until age 72, which is great. If you're still working at 70 and a half, you'd rather not begin minimum distributions until later when you're going to have greater need of funds. That will allow you perhaps, A, to put more money away, and B, to later on receive larger distributions. Now, under current law, if you are a participant in a private employer retirement plan and you continue to work, as long as you're not a 5% owner, you can delay commencing minimum distributions for as long as you are working, even if it is part-time. This does not apply to IRAs, so this benefit, Bob, would allow everyone who participates in a 401k, for example, or now an IRA, to wait until age 72 to commence minimum distributions.
All right. I would like to pick up and ask a question with regards to the still working, but only after we come back from hearing what NITP can do for the listeners.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial, transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to the June 3rd, 2019 For Your Benefit show. We're talking taxes, estate taxes, personal income taxes with the tax whiz kids, Dave DeJong and Steve Woodis. They're estate and tax attorneys with Stein, Sperling, Bennett, DeJong, Driscoll in Rockville. Okay, we were just winding up some of the estate, and you mentioned at the break, why don't we talk a little bit about step-up and basis. What is step-up and basis to begin with?
Yeah, it sure is an odd term, Bob. Inherently between the estate taxes and the income taxes, there's a little bit of a conflict. For estate taxes, we traditionally want to keep things lower. But now with the greater estate tax exemption, it's not as big a concern for most people. And traditionally, we've wanted to make big gifts to get things out of one's estate. However, the step-up in basis was preserved. That simply means that if somebody receives assets that other than, say, assets that haven't been taxed yet, like IRS or commissions, something like that, so if their stock or a home that was bought at a very low value but is included in the decedent's estate, there is generally a step-up in basis, so the beneficiaries receive it as if it was purchased for the date of death value. So if I buy a home for $50,000 and I die when it's worth $200,000, my beneficiaries, if they turned around and sold it a month after I die, then generally only to the extent that they sold it for more than $200,000 would there really be any capital gain. So in a way, including it in one's estate or revocable trust has an advantage that it can reduce income taxes, even though traditional estate planning said, why wouldn't we want to gift lots of assets out of there? This is still a valuable one and should be protected for many people.
Okay, I just have to read. We get emails, and this one is good. This is an individual that also has a tax practice, but works for the federal government and does taxes, if you will, in his spare time. And the 1,000-mile view in his case was the clients that came in that were maybe not working full-time or retired, and maybe there wasn't a ton of income, may have been bitten a little bit about the change in the law because it did away with certain things that they got in the past. And then he went further into the people that were working, and maybe they had the income, and you all mentioned this thing called the SALT tax, state and local income tax. Dave, I think, talked about that. And I love his, he says, by the end of the day, at least half of the clients seem to benefit, but not typically advertised in the thousands of dollars. And then his last comment, I like this. By the way, nobody left our office with a copy of a postcard size return.
Anyway. I think a lot of people, Bob, were expecting bigger refunds than they got. But IRS, within a couple of months of the enactment of the legislation, did new withholding tables. And probably most people did not notice that they had an increased net income. So when it came time to prepare their taxes for 2018 earlier this year, they forgot about it and their refund ended up smaller. The individual who dropped the note noted a lot of other little things that are gone from the law, but people look forward to those deductions. A number of tax breaks were enacted in the last decade, and they were extended many times on a 1 or 2 year basis and expiring after 2017 were certain things such as allowing the private mortgage insurance to be treated as if it were interest, and people who paid the PMI deducted it for a number of years. Well, it expired after 2017. And interestingly, Congress now, this is as late as they've ever dealt with these extenders, is considering extending many of them, and it would be retroactive to the start of 2018, and that's going to mean amended tax returns.
Wow. Could I ask you a question? This is a thousand-mile view again. When I saw this going through, of course, I called you not at every opportunity, but just to explain the unintelligible part of it. But if we looked at people's taxes, and you mentioned this, that at the end of 18, when the returns were being done, the refunds were maybe disappointingly low, and sometimes in the cases balance due. Now, this is my take on it. The law passes 3 days before the end of the year. There's no way the withholding charts are ready for January and February. Let's say January anyway, maybe into February. So we probably had too much withheld because it was being withheld on. And then do you think – this is not paranoid. Do you think they baked into the remaining 10 months a lower withholding amount to make up for that? Or, you know, to put money in people's pockets. Now, I don't think they did that with any ill intent. They actually said, this will put money into your pocket. And I think people thought, boy, I'll get a bunch of money in my pocket and I'll still get a big refund. Well, you can't have both.
I think people always have great expectations with every significant tax bill. And except for those who benefit to a huge amount by a specific provision, the changes are not dramatic, and that causes disappointment.
Okay. Very good. So, all right, enough of my soapbox, but I mean, I would try to explain it to people, and they seem to buy into it, at least as long as we were talking. I don't know what they did when they hung up.
Well, but Bob, jumping in, it seemed to me that I've heard of so many people that were very disappointed because they assumed this was a massive income tax refund that everybody would benefit from. And while I believe some did, this was not an across-the-board situation. I mean, the SALT, the lack of the essentially the limitation on the state and local tax deduction and other matters Dave has noted – have been a disappointment to some. It's not a blanket income tax reduction for a lot of people.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, Bob, looking forward, we were talking about the retirement plan legislation that's in the works, and there's two other provisions that I'd like to mention. One of them is that the House passed bill has eliminated the restriction on contributing to traditional IRAs after reaching 70 and a half. You can contribute to a Roth after 70 and a half under current law, but traditional deductible IRAs, you are not able to contribute once you have hit that age. The House legislation, if ultimately enacted, would allow you to contribute irrespective of age if you have the earned income to support, as opposed to investment income, to support the deduction. That's the good. along with the age 72 in the House bill. The bad is that a number of people who have inherited so-called stretch IRAs, where they're able to take out uninherited IRAs over the rest of their lives, particularly if they are young beneficiaries, may be eliminated, except for spouses, minor children, disabled or chronically ill beneficiaries. The proposed legislation would require, when somebody inherits an IRA or a qualified retirement plan interest, with some exceptions, such as defined benefit plans, you would have to take the entire balance out within 10 years of death of the account holder or plan participant.
Let me jump in on one thing that I think people have to understand, that there are really two major philosophies here. One is that to try to permit people to put in money for a longer time, or maybe change when they have to start withdrawing their monies, the 72, or permitting the continued contributions, goes on the acknowledging that people are living longer and retirement plans should be there, part of that whole three-prong analysis, aside from government benefits, private benefits, and other ways, Social Security, whatever. But the fact is, there's also a trend to push the distributions out sooner if it's not the participant or the spouse. There's a little bit less asset protection. There's more of a feeling that the trend should be that they will likely have to take it out sooner and more quickly. There is one bill that was introduced to permit a longer term, but the trend of the bills seem to be that if it's non-spouse or non-participant, they're going to have to take out a little bit quicker than before. But that hasn't been passed into legislation yet.
And that's pretty consistent with the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of years ago did not give the same protection to inherited IRAs as they did to IRAs in one's own name. They are not protected in bankruptcy if inherited, because an inherited IRA is not considered a retirement plan in the hands of the heir.
Let me ask you a question. Going back to this still working rule, somebody age 70 and a half or older would still be able to put money, if I'm not mistaken, into a Roth IRA. They can do that?
Yes.
But not a traditional?
Correct.
Okay. If they can, is there any end zone? In other words, okay, we'll give you a pass from 70 and a half to 80 and a half, or is it just after 70 and a half you can do it until you are no longer with us?
There is no stopping point on that.
And remember, for the participant and the spouse, there is no 70 and a half age requirement to start withdrawing, unlike a traditional IRA or, the other kind of retirement.
I'm not so sure a lot of people know that.
Well, it's a major benefit to a Roth IRA that people should remember, that once it goes to the kids, then they do have to start withdrawing it, but not for the participant or the spouse if it's a Roth IRA.
In some of your planning meetings, this stuff comes out of the back of my head somewhere, alrighty, and somebody is nearing 70 and a half but doesn't have a Roth IRA, but probably the size of their traditional, or if they move the thrift into the IRA, it's pretty sizable. But with that person, I guess it's going to depend on income and taxes, convert some of that to a Roth.
The answer to that is they have to consider it, and it's going to be based on their individual facts and circumstances. If they don't need it at age 70 and a half, and particularly if they can pay the taxes currently that apply on the traditional IRA balance, if it's moved to the Roth from outside assets, then it could be a great opportunity to preserve wealth.
That's good. Now, the thrift is not a 401k. It's got its own code section number, but I don't know if that would change anything. I think it'd be unfair to ask the question because we all don't necessarily deal with that, but it, yeah.
I believe it would be similar rules.
I would think it would be, but as we talk, I think I will ask the folks, the good folks at the thrift, are you like these other people? All righty. Now we're coming to the final 3 minutes, Andrew, 4 minutes. Final thoughts, comments, anything you didn't do that you want to do?
Generally, I think that people have to remember to try to get their plans up to date. But there is a chance, and we have to be aware that there is a little bit of a political football here. Dave may want to address some of the income tax considerations, but there is a bill that was introduced, and the more on the liberal side to try. There's some thoughts that should we reduce the federal estate tax exemption back to $3.5 million? That's been proposed by a couple of the leading contenders on the Democratic side. There's also one that rather than 2026 would like to make this, bringing it back to essentially the half the value that would make it essentially a $6 million exemption to make that effective for 2024. I believe that passed the House, but they say it's DOA, dead on arrival in the Senate, but there is some support for that. So thinking that this $11 or $12 million exemption will be around forever is probably not going to be the practical situation here.
On the income tax side, if we have a Democrat in the White House and Democratic control of both houses of Congress, we can expect the top bracket to go up to 39.6% for the third time, and perhaps a surtax on those who have the highest levels of income.
And Dave, do you think the capital gains law would change on that?
It has not had material changes in recent years, but it could be vulnerable to higher rates as well.
Okay, we're vulnerable to the time. So final quick comments, and how does one contact you?
Well, we're at Stein Sperling. Bennett, DeJong, and Driscoll. Of course, Dave's name is in there, which is important. We're located in Rockville and 301-340-2020 or by email. And we'd be glad to, follow up with this. And we appreciate being on the program, too. Thanks, Bob.
Did the phone number come with your clarity?
With the 2020?
Vision.
It just happened to be there. So
I'm sure. Anyway, thanks, guys. Always a pleasure. And thanks for listening. Andrew, thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.